It was a treat to do my daughter's wedding, be there for it. I'm not sure whose Bible I'm about to set down over here, but if you know who it is and they're looking for it, it will be on this chair. An incredible time to do that, and so that was really fun. By the way, in case you're planning on doing this, just pretty much cancel the rest of your schedule for the preceding 6 months before this. The number of details that go into marriage simply takes my breath away. I should say wedding. I wish you paid that much attention to the marriages. The weddings are very well tended, I have noticed, in terms of all the activities, events, concerns, and things associated with it. What I would like to do today is to talk a little bit about Jesus is our master. And I got to thinking about that topic. And whereas Americans don't really do masters, do we? I mean, if you talk about a master, you're talking about a dog, usually, right? I was reading Bum Phillips was, probably a Hall of Fame football coach. And for a long time, he was a coach of the Houston Oilers, and he passed away not that long ago. But you get a bunch of Bum Phillips stories when a thing like that happens. And he was famous both for being a family man, but also a dog lover. And one story that was told that brought these two together, he had taken his kids out to play football in the afternoon before dinner. They'd gone out to some nearby school or something, and the neighborhood kids are all out there, and they're all playing football, and the dog had come along with them. And when they got out there, he turned to the dog and said, "Sit." And the dog sat, you know, and that way he didn't mess up the football game and all this. Well, a couple hours after football game's over, they're back home eating dinner, and somebody asks, "Where's the dog?" And everyone's looking around, and they go, "No way." They look outside, you know, they look at his favorite little haunt in the living room. "Where's the dog?" Somebody finally runs back to the football field, and there's the dog still sitting. And you go, wow, what a picture of having a master. He says, "Sit," and you sit, until he tells you to move, at which time you move. But he hadn't said move, so I was still sitting. I don't know what he would have done that night. I don't know when the dog was planning on coming home under emergency circumstances. But as an illustration of having a master, that's a pretty good one, right? But you think about that, we don't apply that to people. If you apply the concept master or even use the word master relative to a person, you're almost always using it relative to them mastering some skill or ability. So for example, you master the piano. But you would never say you mastered the pianist, right? You don't get to do that because the pianist is a person. Master the piano all you want, but you do not master a person. And by and large, my sense is we view that as a virtue, in fact, because master implies slave. And slave is really bad. So we feel pretty good about the fact, I mean, whatever our history is, we all understand this, we've got a few problems in the past in America, whatever our history is, by golly, we don't do this stuff anymore, we don't do master and slave, and by and large, we feel good about that structure. Now, let me just let that thought stand as it is. I won't refute that. I won't tell us that we should think that masters are actually good or that slaves are good or whatever. I just want to make a simple observation. Jesus says, "You call me master and Lord, and you say well, for so I am." What do you make of that passage? Because Jesus is literally saying, "I am your master. You call me master? Well done, because that's what I am." And if you feel a certain amount of tension when you read this passage from John 13:13, let me just make an observation, and that is simply this. As a modern American, you are ill-equipped culturally to understand an important part of Christian discipleship, namely relating to Jesus as if he were your master. Because, of course, he is, right? But we don't bring a lot of things to the table to help us conceive of what that would really mean. And most of the things we bring to the table are very negative. So what I'd like to do this morning is to think a little bit about what I think will be a somewhat awkward topic, namely that Jesus claims to be our master. And I'm going to do two things. First, talk a little bit about what that means, and then talk about the implications of that for us on a daily basis. So let me begin by talking about a passage that I just have to pause and think here. I'm not sure actually uses the word master in this particular passage, but when you read it, you will quickly pick up on the idea whether the word is used or not. The concept is thoroughly there. And I'm going to start by looking at that passage and look at some other ones that relate to this, because honestly, Jesus calling himself a master or Lord over us is very prevalent throughout the Gospels. We like it when Jesus is sort of touchy-feely, but there's a lot of master language in the Gospels. So let me read Luke chapter 17, verse 7 through 10. So this is in the midst of a series of parables and teachings Jesus is giving, many of which are kind of hard. The disciples aren't really liking it. Some of these are hard things he's saying to the Pharisees. Others are challenges he's giving to the disciples. But this is kind of a series of difficult passages for people to hear. And this is sort of stuck right in the middle of that. And here's what he says. Will any one of you who has a servant plowing or keeping sheep say to him when he comes in from the field, come at once and recline at table? Will he not rather say to him, prepare supper for me, and then dress properly and serve me while I eat and drink? And afterward, you will eat and drink. Does he thank the servant because he did what was commanded? So you also, when you have done all that were commanded, will say, we're unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty. How do you like that one? Want to go back and reread it? Maybe we should memorize this. Isn't it just a little bit creepy? Even if they thanked at the end, that would make me feel better. Acknowledge the fact that somehow I've made some great sacrifice that should be, you know, thanked at the very least. But he says, would you even thank the servant? Because he's only done what he's supposed to do. Wow. And when I read a passage, I mean, let me just be real clear up front. I am not speaking about this because I have thought deep thoughts about the mastery of Jesus, and I have submitted myself to that mastery for the last 40 years, and I'm teaching out of the rich depth of my acceptance of this topic. I am processing my own reaction to this, okay? So just hang in there with me, because I'm going, wow, this does strike me. It's kind of funny. When the first thing you do, I don't know about you, but for many of us, the first thing you do when you read a passage like this is you start hoping the Greek will solve the problem. Maybe master really means something more like youth intern or some other, you know, servant, youth intern. That kind of works for me. That could be okay. The original passage I quoted from John, the word in the original is rabbi. You call me rabbi and Lord. Oh, that sounds good until you find out that the word rabbi means great one. And usually it's properly translated master, and it didn't really have the academic teacher connotation until about 100 years after Jesus was using it. It was pretty much of a master-like word. It was definitely used for master teacher, but it was used plain old for a master. It was an honorific kind of title. And I began rooting around in the Greek, and the Greek didn't do me much good because it pretty much, the Greek cognates, which they use all interchangeably with this, one of the other ones that goes with it is despotos, the word from which we get despot, Lord, rabbi, teacher, master. Bottom line is those words pretty much mean what you think they mean. Greek, English, probably Polish too, haven't checked. But there you have it. And then you might say, well, okay, but it's kind of a parable. Well, just to make a note, there's a whole package of parables all around here. The passage I just read really isn't a parable, right? It's just an illustration. I mean, he isn't talking about an actual master and an actual servant, but he's saying, guys, if he had a servant, how would you treat him? It's just cited as kind of an illustration, number one. And number two, if it was a parable, the thing you always say about the parable, oh, you know, the tricky thing with the parable is you don't want to read too much into the details, because the main point between the parable is the only point that's being made, kind of like a joke. The point is to get the main point at the end. The problem with that, with all the master parables, the main point is that he's the master. That doesn't help you any. And then you think of things, you know, Jesus saying, hey, we don't do lordship the way the rest of the world does. The Gentiles lord it over others, but it isn't going to be that way among you. Ah, maybe that helps. But then you think about that for a minute. So what was the punchline of that teaching? That you're supposed to be the slave of all, right? Oh, you feel like you're being surrounded at this point? And confronted by a sort of brutal fact that at some point there is, in a relationship with Jesus Christ, a sense of master and servant, or dare I say even slave, that should characterize the way we relate to him. So let me talk a little bit about that. And first I'm going to talk about things that seem perhaps kind of according to expectation with this, because there's a lot of things that are. And then I'm going to talk about a few things that are probably less according to expectation, and some of the ways in which the mastery of Jesus might look different than other people do. The first thing you see in this passage is that the master is the commander. Isn't that what the passage is about? I mean, he just says, the guy comes in from the field, and you give him a command, and he does it. And you see that sort of a sense, and the interesting thing in this case, when you think of the commands, is that his commands come first. What are first things? His things. When you come in from the field, do you do your stuff first or his stuff first? Well, in this passage, the answer seems to be his stuff first. His things are first things. And boy, I started thinking about that one and realized I'm not really great at that. Here's part of my deal. I really don't mind spending time with Jesus at all. I mean, for heaven's sakes, I'm a Bible professor, okay? But I do have an interesting kind of personality profile, and this, I'm sure, varies with different people, but I'm sure many of you are similar to me on this point. I kind of like to clear my decks and get kind of my to-do list taken care of, and then I can really focus on things. And here's the thing I've discovered, and it gets worse as the years go by. Number one, your deck gets bigger and bigger. So it takes longer and longer to clear the deck. The other thing is you get a bunch of people running around on the deck. So by the time you're done cleaning the deck all the way to the back, the beginning of the deck is dirty again. And if you're waiting to get your to-do list done, guess what? By the time you've worked it to the end, the beginning is already needing to be tended again. And if you don't do his things first, you'll probably never do them. Stephen Covey tells a story that's become rather famous about a guy who had a bucket, and he put some big rocks in the bucket, and he asked the audience, you know, is the bucket full yet? And, you know, they shake it a little bit and say, yeah, it's full. Well, then he takes out some gravel, and he puts it on top of gravel, shakes it down, and says, oh, no, you could get the gravel in, and say, okay, is it full now? Say, yep, it's full now. Then he grabs a bucket of sand, and he pours the sand into the bucket and shakes it down. Oh, my gosh, it wasn't full. He says, is it full now? Yes, now that you have sand and it's full. And then he takes a gallon of water and pours the water into the bucket. And he asks the audience, you know, what's the lesson you learned from this? And people go off and say, oh, you can do a lot more than you think you can. You think you're all full, but there's more. He says, no, that's not the lesson at all. Here's the lesson. If you didn't put the big rocks in first, would you ever get them in at all? And the answer is no. The only way you get the big rocks in is to put them in first. And let me argue that the Jesus stuff is the big rocks. It has to go into your schedule first, or else it won't go in at all. I am like a living testimony to this. So not only did my daughter decide it was time to get married, She decided to do that in the middle of the time that Sherry and I are doing this massive reconstruction, deconstruction of our house. And then just for the fun of it, God said, how about an earthquake? So we got an earthquake, and our house has a crack right square down the middle, tip to tail, stem to stern. There's a nice little crack from the earthquake. And so things kept getting worse and worse and worse. And you know what happened to my to-do list? It kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's these pieces of the construction that are my job, even though I'm paying people to do it. And I had spring break. I was 8 days into spring break, and it dawned on me I hadn't had a meaningful quiet time in 8 days. And what did I discover? I wasn't putting the big rocks in first. And I was trying to negotiate a settlement with Jesus. It was your earthquake, okay? Yeah, I mean, all these things come through my mind about, and the bottom line is, Rick, first things. Do we need to have any other conversation? Did you do the first things first? The answer is no. At this point, you should probably just kick me out of church, right? What is this guy talking about? Because he doesn't do what he says. I'm just telling you, I struggle with this stuff. And part of it is exactly this issue of just realizing I have this bent to want to get my decks cleared, to get it all settled, and I think I want Jesus to be my destination instead of my companion for the journey. And the bottom line is Jesus is our companion for the journey. When we get to the destination, this really won't be a problem. The problem is presencing him in the midst of the journey. And when I start playing after I'm done, the destination game, I'm playing the wrong game for life on this earth. Beginning today, first things need to come first. So in that sense, Jesus is our commander. He gives us the things that are the first things. The other thing that's kind of striking in here is that his commands aren't just the first things, they're kind of the final things. He doesn't explain. He doesn't defend. He doesn't cajole. The guy comes in from a long day in the field and he says, make me dinner. Period. I like explanations. If Jesus wants to give me a command, I'm like, good, well, talk to me about that command. What do you mean by that command? What good will come of that command? I'd like to understand it. And he goes, I'd like you to obey it. But I'd like to understand it. Yes, but I'd like you to obey it. Well, if you explain first, then I could obey later. And then it's like, how about if you obey first and you'll understand later? I don't like that as well. I'd like to get the explanation first. No explanation in this passage. As you mentioned before, not even a thank you. He just says, do it. How often have you felt Jesus asking you to do something without an explanation? And then we get into this whole wrestling match with Jesus because you don't understand. Why does he want me to do this? Why do I have to do this? What is the point of all this? I don't get it. And there's nothing wrong with Jesus explaining, and he often does make things clear to us, and you find him explaining parables. It isn't illegal for Jesus to explain. But just as a reminder to remember that part of the prerogative of a master is to give commands without explanation. And please never hear that as meaning he gives commands without reasons. I have every confidence he has a reason. It just is reason doesn't always get explained to you and to me. And nonetheless, the expectation is when you relate to Jesus as master, is you do the things that he commands, with or without the explanation. Another thing that's interesting in this passage is kind of the close of it. At the end he says, so when all is done, all you're going to say is, hey, we're unworthy servants. We've just done our duty. And usually the idea here is that you've only barely done your duty. You're lucky if you manage to do your duty, right? You've done nothing other than what was fitting. Because he is indeed the master, and you are indeed the servant. And he didn't ask you to do something that was inappropriate for a master to ask of a servant. In other words, the person pictured in this is probably the one servant of a small landholder, because he's first tending the field, and then he's making the dinner, and then he's, you know, he's the guy who just does everything. And the bottom line is that's just one of the things on his little job description. You do those things. Jesus isn't asking, the master isn't asking something inappropriate in this passage. It's all very, very fitting for the things that he's meant to do. So, just as a quick overview, these are some of the things that goes into being a master, and it isn't a thing we normally like, it isn't a thing we normally expect, and honestly, even in most work situations in modern America, you don't usually have those kinds of relationships. You don't relate to other people as a master. And it requires a certain amount of mental effort to conceive of that as being part of our relationship with Jesus. Now, another thing that's interesting about the masters in the Bible, so I'm giving you a little list of things we kind of expect of a master. One is master is commander. The other thing is master is judge. You thought the commander thing was bad. Try this one on for size. And this is part of a whole genre of parables where you have basically a master, and that might be a person's literally name is master in the parable. It could be a nobleman. It could be a vineyard owner. Whatever it is, the owner, the master, the guy in charge talks to the servant, gives the servant something to do, and then the master comes back. And what does the master do? He judges, right? I gave you 10 talents. What did you come up with? Here's 10 talents back. Cool. I gave you 5 talents. What did you come up with? Here's 5 talents back. I gave you 1 talent. What did you do? I wrapped it up in a little handkerchief and I buried it in the ground. And how does that end? Yeah, depart from me, you wicked servant. I condemn you with your own words. So note, and I'm not trying to say every judgment ends bad. I'm saying actually 2 of the 3 ended good there, right? My point is simply that he comes back and judges. That's part of what the master does. And I started reading these things just in the Gospels, and I go, wow, there's a lot of this stuff. So Matthew 13, the servants of the master of the house came to him and said, Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? This is the parable of the wheat and the tares. Didn't you sow good seed in your field? How then is it that it has weeds? And then what does the master say? Well, let them grow up together, and then at the end of the age, in effect, we'll judge them. We'll separate the wheat from the tares. We'll gather the weeds first, bind them in bundles to be burned. The wheat will be gathered into the barn. The master is planter, the master is judge. Luke 12. The people with the lamps getting ready for the wedding thing. Keep your lamps burning. Be like the men who are waiting for their master to come home from the wedding feast. Blessed are the servants whose master finds them awake when he comes. You must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour that you do not expect. He's gone. He's coming back. Upon coming back, he will judge. So be ready. Be ready. Luke 16, there was a rich man who had a manager who was charged with managing his possessions, found out he was wasting them, and he called and said, what is this I hear about you? Turn in an account of your management. And the guy's response was, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from him? He doesn't have to wonder what the judge will be, by the way. He knows he's been cheating. So he's like, as soon as he knows he's going to be judged, he says, and he's going to take this management away from me. Wow. Nobleman goes off to a distant land, comes back, a man with a vineyard, let it out to tenants, expect to harvest, all of these things built off the same principle. He entrusts something to someone, he comes back to check it out. He gives us gifts, he lets us use them as we see fit, but so as to honor him, because we know that he will demand an accounting. And at the end of that process, I should point out, he rewards us accordingly. And frequently in these parables, he rewards with blessing. But the point is, he also rewards with punishment because he seriously is giving you a reward for what you have or haven't done. And this is a relentless pattern in these master-servant parables in the Gospels. Part of what a master does is he judges, and he'll judge us. Third thing that happens a lot in these ones and other related parables is the master is a title that means, and the parables around it often are associated with ultimately worship kinds of context. So you see this Lord, Lord language that you see in the sheep and the goats where Jesus sitting on the great white throne. You see Thomas falling down once he puts his hands and sides in his hand in the side of the resurrected Jesus, calls him Lord, you know, and Master, and Jesus accepts that worship from Thomas. This is a common term associated in a context of worship, and it shows the kind of regard that a master should have. So I would argue all these are things we probably more or less expect of the master thing. I'm just saying they aren't all things that make us comfortable, but I'm just saying these are things that are there, and this is part of that relationship. Now, there's other things about how Jesus relates to us as master that are perhaps less expected. The first thing actually comes from the passage I was talking about where Jesus says, hey, you're right. You call me Lord and Master, and you're right to do that. And then what does he say? Do as I have done. And in this case, the master becomes the model for what we are to do. Now, that's probably a little counterintuitive to us, right? Because oftentimes what we think of as a master is a person who gets the slave to do all the dirty work, all the things that he or she wouldn't want to do for themselves, right? And that's exactly not what Jesus is doing. He's saying, I don't serve the master role so I don't have to do the dirty work. In fact, I model the doing of the dirty work. This is one of the things my mom beat into me. Beat's a bad word for this, but it felt like it verbally beat into me when I was growing up. And she said, Rick, never ask anyone to do something that you wouldn't do yourself. It's a pretty good piece of advice. Now, the one thing I've discovered after 56 years of having that haunt my mind is it makes me a lousy delegator. Because I have a hard time, whenever I'm about to tell someone to do something, I ask myself, but do you want to do that? The answer is often, no, not really. And then I feel like, well, therefore I should do it. And then it ends up undelegated. And after a while, as you begin to gain responsibilities, you can't not actually delegate. You have to let some of these things go. But man, do I have that deeply wired in me that you don't ask people to do things that you wouldn't do yourself. And notice that's very much true of Jesus in this pattern. The thing that he had just done was to wash the disciples' feet, one of the lowest tasks a slave could do. And he says, look, I am your Lord and Master, and what have I just done? I have done it, the most menial act of service to you guys. I want you to go and do likewise. So he is a model for the kind of service we render, not just a master who tells us to do things that we don't want to do. Another thing that's interesting, I was doing some reading about this week, and I bumped into a whole, because we have, you know, master and lord are sort of synonyms, I bumped into some things about the usage of the word Lord. They had a whole section in his dictionary about Lord associated with the Lord's Supper. And I thought, yeah, that's fine. That makes sense. I don't know what they have to say about that, but it seems natural because we always think of the Lord's Supper. But the thing that the person pointed out is, do we realize how paradoxical, almost oxymoronic, that phrase, the Lord's Supper is, or the Lord's table, or the Lord's cup? We use all this terminology together around the communion table. But do you notice what the communion table is? It's the death of Jesus. And he says, do we realize how inappropriate it is that our Lord should die on our behalf? When you hear the phrase Lord's Supper, Lord's Table, Lord's Cup, it should sound to you a little bit like the general's bayonet charge. Well, actually, I know the army does bayonet charges, but usually the general isn't doing that, right? He's telling the privates and the corporals to do a bayonet charge. We don't talk about the president's dish rag. Presidents don't do dishes. There's something just inappropriate. And the Lord doesn't do sacrifice. The servant does the sacrifice, but not with Jesus. In the case of Jesus, he simply is the sacrifice that we remember. Again, it's part of that modeling thing, perhaps you might say, taken to the extreme. So he models that. He is the one who is this kind of sacrifice on our behalf. The other interesting thing that Jesus talks about, which is pushes back against the typical notion of mastery is that he calls us friends. So in John chapter 15, he says, I don't just relate to you as a servant or slave, but I call you friends. The master doesn't always tell the servant what to do or why they're doing it, give an explanation. Remember, we talked about that before. And he says, but I call you friends, and I include you in this. And you see this sort of attention about Jesus' mastery. This is because of the relationship he grants to us. It's very different than you'd normally figure with a master-slave. Now, you may be wondering, so how the heck does all that fit together then? Look, I'm just delivering the goods. I already told you I have a hard time with this stuff, and this is one of those paradoxes with Jesus. He really is both master and friend. It's a strike. He is both master and sacrifice. He is both the one who commands and the one who models. And so he is a complex master that we relate to in that regard. And I'm simply observing all these things are true of his role towards us as master. So hopefully this clarifies just a little bit of our thinking. And then before we're done, I just want to make a few comments about how this then would affect the way we live on a daily basis. And so one obvious application could be to obey his commandments. Obey the Ten Commandments. Don't commit adultery. If that was one of your plans for the coming week, let me encourage you to cancel it. And that would be a totally appropriate application. Perhaps it might even be the most important application. Don't murder, don't steal, don't lie. Those are really good commands. They are his commands. They're the commands of a master. They ought to be obeyed. We don't need to even question that. Let's just put that on the table and acknowledge, yes, that's important. But there's a lot more mundane places where this applies. It might, in many ways, for many of us, be more important. And here's one way to think about it. This is part of what really hit me and got me going on some of this, is that, in effect, your master is the one who makes your have-to list. What do I have to do? Do you wake up in the morning feeling like you have to do things? I've got to do this. I've got to do that. I mean, that's me. And I don't know if I'm haunted by, you know, memories of mom or, you know, whatever the deal is, but I feel a pretty high sense of responsibility. My have-to list gets pretty darn big. And the interesting thing about the master is the master is the one who actually writes the have-to list. Everything else is a get-to, want-to, could-do list. The master is the one who should be writing our have-to list. And I'm going to talk in a second about some of the things that Jesus might on that list, but I just want to make the observation that there's a lot of other people who would love to go to work on your have-to list, tell you things you have to do. For some of us, that's us, ourselves. We're pretty good at making ourselves what you might say the master. You know, even if we didn't drum that up on our own, which I think as sinful people, we're usually pretty good at being self-centered, right? I mean, it doesn't take a lot of training. We pick up on that fairly naturally. But in case we were short on that, Madison Avenue is covering for us. So we get relentlessly bombarded with these messages like, you deserve fill in the blank. You deserve some new car. You deserve a new cell phone. You deserve, you deserve, you deserve. You know what I Googled? I Googled, you deserve the best. In quotes, so only that exact phrase would appear. You know how many hits I got? 13 million. That got me intrigued. I thought, let me try God is love. There's another good phrase, exact quotes. A little over 5 million. 2.5 times as many you deserve the best as God is love. Those are the messages we get, right? I deserve this. The you focus. I bumped into someone who was commenting about this, and she was actually in advertising, but she talked about the you decade, and she says, after years of talking about us, marketers have now started talking about you. They're eager to tell you how important you are. Look around you. Yahoo's latest campaign says the internet service giant is totally you, of course, with one of those little Yahoo exclamation marks after the Y and you. You know how that works. The internet is under new management, yours. There's a new master of the digital universe. Who do you think it is? You! Oh, isn't that great? HTC says you don't need a new smartphone. You don't need to get a smartphone. You need a smartphone that gets you. I just feel better knowing that that's the way the world should be ordered. Medicine Center up in San Francisco, you are unlike any other. we give you this customized offer. Philadelphia's new slogan, life, liberty, and you. Wow. Back in the good old days when you did advertising, Uncle Sam wanted you. You were being summoned to the front lines, right? Not becoming God, you were being sent off as a soldier. Smokey the Bear wanted you too, but you were supposed to be responsible and put out forest fires, right? Nowadays, you is to be the king of the universe. You're the one in charge. You want to read a celebrity gossip problem? No problem. You're in charge of your own media. You're the master of your domain. You're the center of the universe. The universe, in fact, we like to call it. President Obama, remember President, you probably don't remember, I don't even remember, President Roosevelt used to give fireside chats. This is a famous radio thing that he did. Well, now Obama has picked up the dynamic equivalent, but it's called your weekly address, because you are so important to President Obama. And just in case you didn't know, you know who the Time Magazine Person of the Year was? I know I shouldn't say things like this because it sounds like I'm boasting, but the Time Magazine Person of the Year in 2006 was me. The good news is it was you too, because actually what it was, the Time Magazine Person of the Year in 2006 was you, all of us. Go ahead and put it on your resume. Next time you apply, I was Time Magazine Person of the Year 2006. They can't argue with it, right? I mean, there it is, right on the cover. This is the world that we live in. And you have this mindset that the world surely ought to revolve around me because, well, I was the person of the year in 2006. What more could I do, right? So we get this mindset. So when you hear this, you think immediately that whatever you want to should become your have to. Whatever my desires are should become the way the world is ordered. And we get in a very perverse mindset about the things we want. Our wants become our entitlements. Our want-to list becomes a have-to-have list. And we begin to organize our lives around our own desires. And it seems like we never stop to think that our desires might possibly be disordered. If you've ever raised a kid, you realize that part of what they roll out of their womb with all kinds of fun things about them, but one of them is not well-ordered desires. Kids want the craziest things, and a big part of parenting is helping a kid understand this is a good desire, this is a bad desire. And I think we think somehow magically at age 18 that all ends until you happen to have a 19-year-old and you realize, whoa, that didn't end. When does disordered desire end? I'm 56. I'll tell you sometime 57 or later. So disordered desires are just part of the deal. And when you become the center of your universe, when you become your master, you become slave to disordered desires, right? Because your own desires are not well formed. And you become a slave to things you ought not serve. You become attached to a set of passions that should have been checked, but weren't. So that's one problem for our have-to list, is when we make it for ourselves, when I am the center, the master of my list. The other thing that happens a lot is we have other people become the master of that list. And that can happen in the really simple, kind of obvious ways where, so I can't blame this on Sherry. We have been producing the world's biggest to-do list for the last X many months. I mean, just ridiculous. But the point is, between the two of us and the rest of the cosmos, we have this whole set of others who are placing commands and demands on both of us. And you feel at some level the responsibility and obligation to do that. And it is interesting to stop and think, how many of these desires are we thinking have to happen? We're trying to get a wedding reception, Southern California reception for our daughter together for Memorial Day weekend. And the things you begin to think, we have to do this because someone else is coming, and you have this whole set of have-tos that come from social expectations. What if the yard had a brown spot? What if the yard was just plain brown? You know what? Likely the cosmos would still turn. I don't think my daughter would get a divorce. I mean, nothing that terrible would probably actually happen, but wow, do social expectations put commands and demands on us and create a have-to list as if they were our master. The other thing that happens sometimes is we're haunted by past relationships that give us our have-tos. oftentimes family relationships. I was just talking about the being my brief tenure as the Time Person of the Year. Well, the only time, as I recall, they've actually done that was 2006. Every other time, it actually was a particular human being, one of which was Ted Turner. Ted Turner had a famously bad relationship with his dad. His dad was a slave driver. His letter, Ted Turner went off to Brown University because he couldn't get into Harvard. That was his dad's first big disappointment, not first, one of many big disappointments with Ted Jr. While there, he decided to major in classics. And his dad wrote them this scathing letter about his, you know, pride and egotism of, you know, majoring in something like that to make you a snob. And Ted Turner gave it to the student paper, and they published it. And so that was his relationship with his dad. So when Ted Turner gets the Man of the Year award, he's at the podium receiving this award. He picks up the magazine, he holds it up, looks up and says, "Is this good enough now, Dad?" Oh, what a burden. He has been a slave to his dad's spoken and unspoken expectations for his entire life. And he gets the Man of the Year award, and he's wondering, am I still man enough to make my dad happy? Sometimes it's other people who make our have-to list. Sometimes I wish those came on a piece of paper so you could actually take them and burn them. Because that's what you need to do with those things. Just burn them. That person is not your master. And at some point, you just have to let go of others as your master. Sometimes the thing that generates our have-to lessons, and this is another one that's big for me, is a vice that we almost never name anymore. We don't even really understand what the name means, though we do still hear it as one of our seven deadly sins, probably. But it's the vice not of pride, though that can also generate your own set of have-tos, right? But of vainglory. Now, let me distinguish between these two, because it's really interesting, and I've discovered for myself it's an important distinction, because the pride thing, in many ways for me on a daily basis, is less of a battle than vainglory is. So pride is a thing you do when you want to somehow exalt or assert yourself above others. You are concerned with other people and being above them somehow. And you are wanting the praise of others, that would go to others. Vainglory is interestingly inverse to that. With vainglory, what you want is the praise of others. You want others to say, well done, you've done a good thing. And you know what happens when you get hooked to that? You do one thing and someone says, hey, that was great. Then you want to go do another thing, and another thing, and another thing. I was doing some teaching things on Friday, and I had to leave a little bit early. I came back home, was doing some stuff, and I got a little text message from one of the guys saying, just wanted to let you know. We were talking afterwards about what you shared and how great it was and blah, blah, blah. And you feel that feeding you, right? Oh, let me go do one more thing. Let me go do one more thing. And the interesting thing here is all these things are good things that you're doing. You're not going out and tearing somebody apart, but you're relentlessly driven by finding the praise of others and the joy that comes from having people praise you. And the funny thing that happens, vainglory in that sense, is glory that's empty, or that, there's a better way to put it, that shouldn't have been yours. Not because you did something wrong, but because there was someone else on the planet who was supposed to do it. But because you have no self-control, they never had the opportunity. Ever been on a volleyball team with someone else who thinks every ball should be theirs? I don't care if they're an Olympic-quality volleyball player. Drives me berserk. Get out of my back line, okay? Take your own balls and hit them back over. Don't hit my. I mean, and there's that sense of things don't work right when one person has to do everything. How do we get sucked into that? How? Partly by vainglory, because we love those words of praise and somehow we can't get enough. We're like a glutton that overeats words of praise. And to be able to stop and say, Lord, the things that you have given me are enough. Let me do those faithfully and accept that wonderful thing. That's what comes at the end of all these parables, right? You actually do get these words of encouragement. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Why? Because I gave you this job and you did it. Not because I gave you 12 jobs that you did 12 and then you took 38 others. Don't expect me to praise you for having done a job that wasn't yours. And what ends up happening is that when we multiply our masters, we multiply our jobs and our burdens become very heavy. And Jesus has this wonderful phrase of, come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Why? Because the only assignments I'll give you are the ones that are suited and fit for you, not for everybody else. And one of the great things about having Jesus as your master is basically you get this wonderful package. You take up your cross, but you lay down your burdens, right? You take up a cross of accepting him as the one who's your master, the maker of your have-to list. And you lay down the burdens of 10,000 other things that shout, have to, have to, have to. Now, now, now. More, more, more. And you say no. His yoke is easy. His burden's light. The price of admission, taking up your cross and following him is your master. And in light of that, perhaps it's not so bad that Jesus is our master, right? Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I don't share these things because they're easy for me. I don't share these things because of a history of great success and having figured these things out myself, Lord. I share these things as a reminder and a calling that I feel to honor you on a daily basis as my Lord and Master. Lord, help that word to be a good word on my tongue. In Jesus' name, we pray. Amen.